Hello and welcome. I'm Henry McKean and this is Under the Covers. Remember, you can tweet me. It's at Henry McKean. Wherever you are, perhaps you're in the kitchen. There'll be some tunes coming up. Maybe you're driving across the nation. Wherever you are, you're very welcome to the programme. So perhaps last Friday you were up the Wicklow Mountains or you were around Deniry Golf Club, around that area. Well, if you were, you might have seen Mason, Hayes and Curran. They were involved in a cycle and a hike to raise money for Child Vision. So well done to everyone in Mason, Hayes and Curran for that. Coming up on today's show, I rummage through the leader of the Green Party's bin, Eamon Ryan. So I'm looking through your bin here. We have a coffee cup. We've got this infamous coffee cup that you're bringing in a bill about today, actually, on this. Someone bought that. But these things, they can't be recycled, can they?
You would think it could be, because they often have little logos on them with the recycling symbol. But that actually means that it's made some materials that might have been recycled. But it itself is a mixture of cardboard and plastic, or card and plastic, and the combination is not recyclable, so it can only go in the black bin.
How long should it take until you say the words, I love you?
It's okay to say I love you when you really know in your heart that you're thinking about that person every minute of the day.
Do you say I love you much?
All the time.
And your partner, how long did it take for him or her to say I love you?
Probably a couple of months.
Couple of months?
Yeah.
Who said it first?
I can't remember.
You can, I know it's personal.
No, I can't really remember whether it was me or him. I think probably he did. But I hope he did.
And I visit one of Ireland's first autism summer camps in Meath.
The adults get to talk about, you know, share their concerns about their children. Maybe there's information that some parents don't have that other parents can impart.
So a great support network.
Yeah, it's a great support network. Given that it is about children on the spectrum, there is nothing else in the area like this. It's fantastic, it really is.
But first, we're going to talk about Airbnb, because it's in the news again, because prices have gone up. So Dublin Airbnb prices have gone up, but are still cheaper than a hotel room. According to Bloomberg, Airbnb hosts in Dublin have pushed up their prices by 16% in the past year, making the capital joint 14th with London, one of the most expensive in the world, with Miami taking top spot as the most expensive. A Dublin hotel room is back to boom time prices at around €160 a night for a room, but Airbnb is still cheaper at about 120. There are 6,000 hosts in Dublin welcoming over 400,000 guests. The average host in Dublin earned 4,900 hosting for 50 nights last year. So I went out and about and I spoke to people about these price increases. And Dublin City Council, they're looking into 25 suspected cases of homes being illegally used as Airbnb or short-term lets. Many of these are in the Temple Bar area. And Green Party councillor Patrick Costello told the Irish Times Airbnb-style rentals is depriving the city of much-needed housing supply. And Airbnb apartments need to be changed from residential use to short-term letting, and you need planning permission to do so. I met Councillor Mannix Flynn, Dublin South Bay, at City Hall, Gotham City. He feels the city has become too busy with tourists from around the world. He touches on bedsits. He also talks about how we've basically reached peak tourism and we need to change things. Here is Mannix Flynn.
It's becoming now unmanageable, like Barcelona and other cities. There's a huge amount of walking tourists, a huge amount of tourists, and all of a sudden you're actually going to have to find you're going to have to manage tourism and keep your numbers actually down. If you're trying to walk these streets now with the tourists that are out there, it's very, very difficult. It's annoying for the tourists and it's annoying for the indigenous population who live within the city. So you can see the streets that we're on here in Dame Street.
We've got small pavements. I mean, people can't get through.
But even in London, where they have massive pavements, in Barcelona, where they have, you know, huge pedestrianised areas, they're having this same problem because there's cheap flights in, there's big tours coming in, they want to walk the city, there's lots of groups there offering them free tours, etc., etc. And there's no protocol and there's no guidelines to how you actually manage your city. You have a guideline on the roads out there where how you manage the Road Traffic Act. Now we need a similar guideline for the footpaths and the walkways in terms of big groups of individuals. In terms of accommodation and facilities, it's a tight city, it's a small city, so Airbnb is going up, hotels are going up, more and more people want to see this city. Now, in terms of bringing in bedsits as a kind of a norm to deal with the housing crisis, I think that the Minister for Housing, Mr O'Murphy, is very, very, very wrong here. What you're doing is you're bringing back a standard that we rejected. It's no place to live. It's no place to even stay the night in.
You remember bedsits.
I remember bedsits, and I see a lot of this kind of activity happen at the moment, where you have houses being occupied by 10 and 12 people at enormous price, and they're sleeping on floors, they're sleeping on double beds, they're sleeping in bunk beds. What you're doing is then you're containing people in almost jail-like conditions. Not good enough, Minister.
So Councillor Mannix Flynn there talking about Airbnb and the city being too full. So what do the tourists think? Do they feel that Airbnb is too expensive? Well, tourists are finding it way more expensive. Here are tourists who have stayed in Airbnb, and this is the first time ever.
I think it's great. I like having the facilities there and comfortability of more space than a hotel would offer at the same equivalent. But I was frequently ripped off by hotels like my whole life, so...
So you're pretty happy?
Yeah, I'm happy with it.
But you can't order room service. Well, I suppose you could order a
takeaway. I actually never really took advantage of a lot of the things you're paying for at a hotel, so this is like you're getting more on par with what you want for your money.
But I think what you're also paying for is a more authentic experience, and it gives you a chance to get immersed in a culture. And often some of the hosts will provide additional information and some recommendations that you get from more of a local perspective versus a more touristy perspective that sometimes you get from hotels.
How much are you paying?
$200 US per night. And there's two of us, so it's $100 per night.
So a little bit cheaper than a hotel.
Yes. We're excited about the location, and we didn't see any hotels in that price range for the same location.
So we contacted Airbnb and they sent us a massive response. They basically say that they don't set the prices, but the hosts do. They go on and they talk about how it really helps people afford their homes. They increase capacity for big events like St. Patrick's Day and the Six Nations. They also go on and say, Airbnb say, when guests travel using Airbnb, local hosts keep 97% of the accommodation charge. And more than half of guests' spending takes place in the communities where they stay, places local residents call home. So here is Airbnb host, and she's been using it since 2015. Here is Elizabeth McGuinness. She hosts in Monaghan, near Castle Leslie. She says it's all about supply and demand. She started using the service way back in 2013, here and abroad.
My first day in Dublin, very lovely apartment, double bedroom, bathroom, €40 a night in January 2013.
40? You wouldn't get that now.
But I don't think Airbnb was as well known then. And because I travel a lot with my business at Kiwi Country Clothing, I travel a lot and I was using it in America and in London and places like that, staying in fabulous places for like $50 or £50 sterling. I used it for the Rugby World Cup in 2015, also in London, fabulous places. The most I paid for a double room for two people was £80 a night in very salubrious accommodation. Airbnb have become unbelievably successful in Ireland, not just in Dublin, but out in the in provincial Ireland as well. I mean, when I started in Monaghan, there were very few people doing it. Now there are quite a lot. However, I would see that incrementally over the last couple of years that Airbnb, the prices are going up in accordance with the hotel prices, which are also going back up, because in 2012, 13, 14, you could still get a decent hotel room in Dublin for €60 to €80 a night. Now they have come back because there's such a shortage. Everybody's increased their prices. With any sort of business or gets too successful overnight and you're running to stay still or the organisation might be trying to catch up, I think it's been a huge success story in Ireland and Dublin to start with and right across the country. I understand there will be a plan of action to build many more hotels in Dublin to accommodate shortage. But then this is also the success of a weak euro and a strong dollar. But at Leinster House in Monaghan, who would have thought it? I mean, you've been to my house, Henry. Who would have thought that, like, provincial Ireland out in the countryside sort of would be so successful?
So there you go. There is Elizabeth, an Airbnb and host, a huge character. And a massive thank you to her, Elizabeth McGuinness, for talking to me. And, you know, Airbnb, it's still cheaper than a hotel, but it's become so popular, prices obviously were going to go up. But what about hotels? Are they feeling the pressure? Well, the CEO of Hilton Hotels Worldwide, Christopher Nassetta, said he does not believe Airbnb is a major threat, because they cater to the needs of a different kind of customer. Well, I met these customers, these, you could say, different customers, the Rivera's family, Joseph and Amanda. They're from the States, but they live here in Ireland and they use Airbnb all the time.
My experience with Airbnb is that it's convenient and it's better than a hotel because you can have like your own home and you can have your own kitchen. You can have a great location in the city centre.
You stay in Airbnb a lot?
All over Europe, as well as a few times in the States. I like the fact that it's personal. I like that I talk to the owners of the homes and I usually meet them. I like that it's a home feeling and not staying in a hotel.
You have a young family. And have prices gone up?
Yes, I think it's very good for a family because you have a more home context with bedrooms that you can close off. In a hotel, you don't have a bedroom that you can close off and have your kids sleeping while you're in the living room. But the prices have gone up exorbitantly, especially if you want a 2 or 3 bedroom. It can be a couple hundred euros or more a night.
So yeah. More than a hotel in place,
Much more than a hotel. Yeah, much more.
I like that we're like away from our house.
I suppose I noticed the prices are a bit more expensive, but I still think they're comparable to other forms of accommodation like a hotel, and they're better for a family.
You live in Ireland.
We do.
But you use Airbnb across Europe.
Across Europe, yeah. And in the States. Love it.
Why?
Well, because I can't stand staying in a hotel with my kids. Do you know, the first time we went on holiday as a family, we put the baby to bed and then we were stuck in a dark hotel room for the rest of the night. We couldn't watch TV, couldn't watch a film, we couldn't talk. You know, it was just dark, we had to be quiet for the kids. And so now we can put them in a room to themselves and then we can stay up and, you know, have a drink or watch a film or just hang out.
So there you go. A huge thank you to that American family there, the Riveras, for talking to me about using Airbnb all the time. And yeah, Airbnb has gone up by 16%, but it's still cheaper than a hotel room. And here is Solid by Ashford and Simpson, the songwriting duo who wrote songs for Marvin Gaye and Chaka Khan before they wrote this massive hit in 1984. Well, it only made number 12 in the US charts, but we're still playing it today, so it's a massive hit. And after that, we're going to be talking about Ireland's first autism summer camp.
And for love's sake, each mistake, oh, you forgave. And soon both of us learned to trust, not run away.
It was no time to play.
We build it up
and build it up
and build it up.
And now it's solid. Solid as a rock. That's what this love is.
That's what we've got. Oh.
Solid. Solid.
was so new. We did what we had to.
I'm going to bring you something a bit different because it is summer camp season. But what about the kids with autism or on the spectrum? Who is catering for them? Valerie Donovan, who has two children with autism, wanted to do something about it. So this week in the Julianstown Community Centre, she set up one of Ireland's first autism summer camps. I went along to find out more.
Hi, my name's Valerie Donovan. I set this camp up because there was nothing in the area for children with autism or special needs. We have a lot of children down here who have ODD, ADHD, sensory processing, anxiety, and also autism. So I have two children on the spectrum. My oldest girl would be quite high functioning and would have a lot of issues with socialisation. So I thought the camp would be good for socialisation. And then my son's non-verbal and he attends Enable Ireland. Any activities that I've been doing with them, I go to gymnastics, I go to Dublin. I'm in Navan for horse riding, swimming, strata. So there was nothing close to home. I'm originally from Dublin, so I'm used to travelling and I don't mind travelling. But when you have a child who has to travel for an hour and then get there, they don't want to do the activity anymore because they're knackered after being in the car.
I'm having a chat with Sarah. You're seven. What do you think of the summer camp?
It's pretty good.
And the fact that your mummy Valerie set it up, what do you think?
It's fantastic.
And what do you think of your mum?
She has a loving heart and she does everything for my brother and my aunt and me.
How do you know she has a loving heart?
Because she does lovely stuff for us.
What's your favourite sport?
Basketball.
Why do you like basketball?
Because you get to bounce the ball and you get to shoot it.
Sam Collins, I'm here today because my youngest boy is on the autism spectrum. The summer camp for the children also thought it was a good idea to involve any other siblings, whether they're on the spectrum or not.
So you've got three kids and you have all three here at this autism summer camp, the first of its kind.
Yes, yeah, which we just find it's fantastic. The eldest boy felt a bit, I suppose, strange the first day because he's not on the spectrum and he thought really it wasn't for him, you know, initially when he came here the first morning, because all of the people involved in the different activities and sports and so on, they were so inclusive and they made it fun. You know, very, very soon after we arrived on the Monday, he was involved and they were having fun. The adults get to talk about, you know, share their concerns about their children. Maybe there's information that some parents don't have that other parents can impart.
So a great support network.
Yeah, it's a great support network. Given that it is about children on the spectrum, there is nothing else in the area like this. It's fantastic, it really is. They're doing yoga today, volleyball today. They did Zumba yesterday. They did soccer, they did GAA, a variety of things. They do some artwork then, so they sit down and they have quiet time. And there's various different experts from all of these areas, you know, have come here to engage with the children and the families in the beginning. When we noticed that maybe, you know, Marcus was a little bit different from the other two boys, was that, say, you know, our other two sons, one is 10, one is 8, even when they started play school, they were going to summer camps. And you'd feel you could just drop them there and be happy that they were safe and that they're going to enjoy the activity. Whereas with Marcus, that was my upset, I suppose. About a year ago, I was worried that he wouldn't be doing the same things. And then a summer camp like this just isn't and wasn't available until now.
My name's Leo.
And you have a brother. What's your brother's name?
Marcus. He's the youngest out of our family. He's 5 years old.
And we're here doing a little bit of ballet. What do you think of the ballet?
It's okay.
And what do you think of being involved in this summer camp with different children on the spectrum, some with autism?
At the start, it's kind of a bit hard because people, like, obviously are, like, different. I didn't know, like, what kind of to do, but it's okay. And another thing is just to treat them like they're real people, like they're exactly the same as us. You can mix with other children, so that's good. And yeah, I think he's enjoying it.
I'm Suzanne Bergen from Coastal Ballet School. We're doing ballet, but we're doing it to funky music to keep the kids' interest up. Plus, it's high energy and it keeps them moving all the time.
And we've got kids with autism on the spectrum and brothers and sisters who are here in support.
Yes, absolutely. It's great to see the brothers and sisters helping out, especially when they're trying to learn new things from the corner and running across. They're actually demonstrating to their younger brother or sister and they're all getting on absolutely brilliantly.
I like to move it, move it.
I like to move it, move it.
I am Councillor Stephen McKee. I'm a local public representative in East Meath, and I'm down here today in Julianstown Community Centre. Every councillor is in receipt of a discretionary fund, and I decided to give Valerie a small donation towards setting up for the cost of setting up the summer camp. And I'm down here today to see what's going on, and it's absolutely fantastic what she's doing. As far as I know, it's the first of its kind in the country.
My name is Mark Gallagher. I'm the juvenile chairman of a local GAA club called St Colum Kills. We're based in the Bettystown, Laytown area, just south of Drogheda. So we have quite a large member base, loads of kids obviously involved, right from 4 years old, right up through the juvenile ranks into adult ladies and men's football. The GAA obviously is more than just a sporting organisation. It's inclusive. It's reaching out to the community in terms of various things, be it from a positive mental health. We were looking to see whether we could help Valerie in terms of getting her summer camp up and running and providing any resources that we could in terms of promoting Gaelic games within the camp itself.
Actually training these children on the spectrum, did they love it? What did they think of GAA?
They appeared to love it, so I hope they had a good time. I think the feedback we got from the parents and from Valerie and the organisers was that it was fantastic to see their smiles on their faces. So, and it's a learning experience for us as well.
So my name is Agni Gusti. I'm a mother of a six-year-old boy, Linus.
So Agni, you're originally from Lithuania, living in Ireland 12 years. Yeah. We're doing a little bit of arts and crafts here. And being involved, how great is it for you, your boy, and other kids on the spectrum?
I think it's absolutely great idea because the kids can feel like everyone else. They're not being judged or they're not being... And same for us parents as well.
So my name is Elaine Banville. I'm Sports Inclusion Disability Officer with Meath Local Sports Partnership. I think everybody really is keen to make all their sports more inclusive, and it just shows here what a bit of perseverance and working together really can do for the kids.
My name's Nuala Lucas. I have a little child, Joshua. He's autistic, non-verbal. He's very agitated. He can't really go out much, so this is actually brilliant for him because he is coming out and he's acting out with other kids. Well, he's not really into acting, but it's great for him. And He'd wake up at 4 o'clock in the mornings every morning, and this week he has slept till 6, which is brilliant, and I just can't believe it. And it's great what Valerie's doing because it's helping him with routine because he likes routine. Over the summer they don't get a great routine, and every morning he's up, he wants to do something, so this is really good for him.
It's just uplifting, I think, for all of the parents that you feel, you know, my other child has the opportunity to do all of these activities as well. And he's taken part in things. And even we had an pet zoo yesterday, and the children had snakes around their necks. And, you know, and for a lot of children on the spectrum, they'd have a lot of sensory issues. You know, a fantastic kind of aid or help, you know, move them past some of their sensory issues and some of their, you know, anxieties around some of those areas.
And the kids loved, they loved
and
the snakes.
And yeah, my three boys, we have pictures on the phone of my three boys. I didn't think they'd do it, actually, especially the smaller boy. He had a snake around his neck. He had a turtle in his hand. He had a little gecko. He petted the gecko. And for our boy, a lot of sudden movement, sudden noises, you know, up until now has been, it's beginning to improve, but has been an issue for him. So, you know, there were noisy parrots in there. He seemed to be fine with it, you know, which was, and when you see they're all, I suppose, milestones that they're, you know, difficulties that they're getting over, it's like they're being desensitized, you know, and nobody was really upset about the noise. Paul's pets, that guy that had the pet zoo, he didn't force the children. He didn't force it on them. He was very, you know, softly approached. So he made it easy for them. Families with the child on the spectrum, the difficulty is that, you know, days out or maybe going to a little restaurant for pizza or things like that can be difficult. And what a lot of families find is that sometimes you need a lot of energy to push yourself to do those things because the child might be upset in some of those, you know, settings or surroundings. But because of all of the different activities they've tried here this week, hopefully all of the families will see the benefits of that right throughout the summer.
My name's Dwayne Hill from Volleyball Island. I actually have a son who's autistic, so I have an interest in children with autism. And teaching volleyball is a great way of physical literacy, working on their hand-eye coordination. And it's also a team sport that they can take part in that's fully inclusive.
And the kids seem to love it, don't they?
They do love it, yes. We keep it very basic, we make it fun, lots of touches, lots of games, and they really, really do enjoy it. They enjoy being part of a team.
My name's Stacey, I'm a primary school teacher, and this summer I'm teaching her little boy Matthew and her little girl Sarah for July provision. So I'm working with them for 40 hours over the month of July. I think it's a wonderful idea. I think Valerie's done a great job in organising all the local community to come together and provide access for a summer camp for children with special needs. It's very hard for children with special needs to access summer camps, and it's a wonderful opportunity for them to come together and even just, you know, get together and talk amongst themselves, because it's very hard for them.
July provision is for any child that's on the spectrum. They're entitled to 2 hours a day over the month of July.
You're wearing a Batman t-shirt. People are calling you a superhero.
They're all trying new things that they necessarily wouldn't have tried, you know, because you're not going to spend 80 to 100 euro to try out something that they mightn't like the next day while they're getting a taste for everything.
And a big thank you to Valerie Donovan and everyone in Julianstown Community Centre in Meath on one of Ireland's first autism summer camps. Massive thank you. And it's great that so many different sporting clubs and different sporting groups from the Leinster branch right through to the GAA are all getting behind this fantastic autism summer camp. So coming up after the break, how long should you wait until you say, I love you? I think Aidan's saying about a month, but, you know, it differs. It's different for everyone. Couple of days. He's gone and clarified that in my ear. So here is Tina Turner and David Bowie tonight, taking us into the ad break.
Everything will be all right tonight. Everything will be all right tonight. No one moves, no one talks, no one thinks, no one walks tonight.
So now we're going to talk about love. Because why not? If you can't talk about love on a Sunday night, when can you talk about it? And according to YouGov, 16% of us told someone they loved them within the first month of romance, and up to 3% declare their love within a week. And this is according to a new survey, which is just absolutely fascinating. 22% took 3 months, 2 to 3 months to say I love you. 14% did the three magic words after 4 to 6 months. 11% took longer than 6 months. And 7% have never been in love. But there's still time. You will find someone out there. If you haven't fallen in love, there's still time. And believe it or not, 2% took 2 years. Well, you know, they do say that love takes time. Here are people from all walks of life telling me how long they took to say I love you. I also met this 20-year-old woman, originally from Poland, living in Ireland. She's pregnant and her boyfriend walked out on her.
About my father of my baby. I thought I love him, but I don't know.
So you're not sure that you love the father of your baby?
Oh, no, I totally don't love him now, right now.
And when is the baby due?
In September.
And there's no sign of him?
No, he's with other girls. That's kind of Eastern European descent.
Do you think you'll find love, even if it's not the father of the baby?
Maybe one day, yeah.
I've actually never had, a serious relationship.
So have you got there? Have you found love?
No. I'm still looking, but I think it will come eventually.
So eventually you'll find a guy?
Yeah, I'm keeping an eye out.
It's a long time ago now.
We've been together 60-odd years.
50-odd years now.
So you're saying 50 years together, you're saying 60. Yeah. So we lost 10 years there.
Yeah, it was early on, I think. We worked together.
Our first date was on St Valentine's Day, so that was February, and we were married in that December.
So you must have said I love you pretty quick.
Yes.
Yes. Well, when I was with my boyfriend, I said it a month in, probably.
Month in? Who said it first?
He did.
So, I mean, it must be about 1960s, 65, say. Oh, pretty quickly, I think. When I first saw Mavis, she was the girl, yeah. That's why I'm pushing around Dublin.
So how often does he say I love you?
Not as often as he used to, but sufficiently. It's
how
very nice.
How important is it to say?
Oh, it's very important. Yeah, it's very important. Let you know that you're still alive, if nothing else.
4 or 5 months.
4 or 5 months.
Spur of the moment thing.
I love you.
Who said it first?
Me.
In days, actually.
Days? Just a few days?
Well, we had known each other as friends and colleagues before.
So you kind of loved each other before you got together, but you didn't know it?
Sort of.
Yes, I think so, yes.
So friends first?
Yes, definitely, yes.
6 months.
6 months.
Six
and
months.
Who said it first?
Probably me.
Really?
See,
so think you said it?
I probably did.
So people from all walks of life, they're talking about love. So how long should you wait until you say, I love you? You know, baby, don't hurt me. What is love? No more. They're not the right lyrics, are they, of Hadaway, are they, Aidan? You're a fan. I think the lyrics are, what is love, baby, don't hurt me, no more. But what is love? It's the million-dollar question. Here is counselling psychologist Leslie Shoemaker. I asked her, what is love?
It's a lovely feeling of just wanting to spend all your time with someone, being just terribly smitten, being mad about them, feeling protective of them, wanting to have your life with them. The survey is kind of consistent with research that they did in America back in 2011, where 39% of the men there said, I love you in the first month, but only 23% of the women did.
Some people have spent 2 years before they said, I love you.
You know what, that's the whole timing thing. And there isn't one-size-fits-all approach. Like we know shy people, it takes them longer. People are more outspoken, they're quicker to say it. Also, what's your track record in this area? If you've been burned a whole bunch, you're going to be pretty hesitant in saying I love you too quickly.
So some guys, they do love the girl or they love the boy, but they just can't say it.
Yeah, that happens. And it could be they lack the vocabulary. You know, like Eskimos have 26 words for snow, but we only have one word for love.
And when we take this show on the TV at the moment, Love Island, everyone loves each other and they all get into bed with each other. Have we cheapened love?
Okay, Love Island, we're not even going to go there. That's not love, that's sex. And you know what? When people have sex, we have great hormone releases. Can that be mistaken for love? Absolutely. Because it's intense, we're really happy, you really want to spend time with the person. But that isn't love.
When should you say I love you? When you mean it, or if you say it too soon, you could scare them off. Or if you leave it too long, you could alienate them and, you know, when should you say it? When should you say, I love you?
don't say it after an intense experience. Like, there were a rake of people in America who got engaged right after 9/11 and then divorced because they did it right after something big, intense. You know, it was like, oh my God, I love you. But really, it was just being swept up in the emotion of the situation. You know, don't do it just after sex. You know, it's find a nice time. Don't make some grand gesture. Keep it simple, keep it easy, and keep it genuine.
So Leslie Shoemaker there explaining love. But can you explain it? Well, it's really difficult to explain. And here is Teresa Brennan. She has fallen in love with her boyfriend, Tom Dunn. Not the one that's coming up after this programme, a different Tom Dunn. She describes basically what is love and how do you know? And my dad, Hamish, always says, you know when you know, if that's clear. Anyway, here is Teresa Brennan.
You really feel it in the gut of your tummy, from the bottom of your heart, you should tell them. So if that's one day for somebody and 5 years for somebody else, I think that's what it should be.
So you've got to feel it deep in your tummy, in the bottom of your tummy.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think it should be confused with infatuation. We all feel that sometimes when somebody is attractive to the eye and maybe something is sparking off between the two of you. But no, I think it should be really when you know that this person makes you feel happy from the inside out and you really could see yourself spending the rest of your life together.
Have you found love?
I have, luckily, yes.
And how long did it take for him to say it?
4 or 5 months, yeah.
So who loved each other first? Who said it first? Did you want to say it?
Well, I think it was maybe in a haze of alcohol. So when it happened, it came out and it was, I think it was from both sides. Both of us seemed to feel the same, but there was never a moment where one said it and the other said, don't say that yet, I don't feel that. So.
Do you think it's harder for men and they need to use alcohol to say I love you?
I think sometimes, yeah. I think sometimes for men it's hard to let down that tough exterior, particularly Irish men. They build it up and they feel that maybe losing their masculinity a little bit when they fall deeply in love and they express it. And that's why I think sometimes the European men can be wonderful for being open with their emotions. But I think we're getting better in Ireland and I don't want to tarnish all men with the one brush. They can show great expressions of romance and affection, but at the same time I think it is a little bit tougher for them. In the play Romeo and Juliet, when Romeo marries Juliet, he feels he's losing his masculinity because he's fallen in love and he feels tender. And I think that Shakespeare hit it on the head. I think all men feel like that sometimes, that they have to be really macho and masculine, and they spend their teen years trying to be a man, and then when they fall in love they feel a sense of vulnerability and a little bit a little bit lost, and the tenderness maybe sometimes confuses them and they feel as though they're not being manly or macho enough when they fall in love.
Teresa Brennan there explaining her love to Tom Dunn, a different Tom Dunn. So what advice is there on love? Well, I met these people and they gave me advice, including this man who was a bit religious.
I ask for 8 things every day. Wisdom, understanding, strength, courage, faith, love, peace and grace. And love is probably, as St. Paul said, probably the most important of them all.
People nowadays, they fall in love very easily and they fall out very easily too, very quickly. So I think it's okay to say I love you when you really know in your heart that you're thinking about that person every minute of the day.
Do you say I love you much?
All the time.
And your partner, how long did it take for him or her to say I love you?
Probably a couple of months. A
couple of months?
Yeah.
Who said it first?
I can't
remember.
You
can, I know it's personal.
No, I can't really remember whether it was me or him. I think probably he did. But I hope he did.
Certainly past the 3 months.
That's too long, is it?
It's too soon.
Too soon?
Yeah, way too soon.
So how long should you wait until you say, I love you?
I suppose when you feel it, you know.
Do you feel it?
No, not at the moment.
So there's no guy there?
No. But yeah, no, I have been told too soon.
Really?
Before, yeah, and it was a bit scary, so.
So it was a little bit too much infatuation, too quick?
Yeah.
And you didn't think it, you didn't feel it?
No, I didn't. So I think maybe, you know, love grows, doesn't it? It's when you meet somebody, when you spend more time with them, when you really get to know them.
And you can't hurry love?
No, you can't. Absolutely not.
So there you go, the YouGov survey, which says 16% of us say, I love you, in the first month of romance. And to bring us into the ad break, here is Jackie Wilson. Your love keeps lifting me higher and higher. And Aidan McKelvey actually released a version of that, a B-side. Our producer here, great song, here it is.
opened up the cupboard and suddenly an avalanche of stuff comes out to you, which we are awash with. We are being drowned in terms of plastics.
Deputy, we're in the Houses. We're in the Houses of Parliament on national television.
Polypropylene.
Deputy, that's not allowed.
Polyethylene.
Advertisements are not allowed in the House.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. This is Under the Covers, and I'm Henry McKean. And we're now going to bring you Eamon Ryan's kitchen bin, because, as you just heard there, that clip that we just played, that was Eamon Ryan in Leaders' Questions recently, in the Dáil, actually going through all his rubbish. And he was trying to introduce his waste reduction bill, which will include a ban on non-biodegradable coffee cups, like the ones that I'm using right now in front of me here in the studio. We can't recycle them because they've got bits of plastic on the inside. Just the average coffee cup, they just go to landfill. He wants to change that. He also wants to introduce a deposit and a refund scheme for plastic bottles, cans and glass bottles. The Labour Party are going to co-sponsor this legislation, which is being debated in the Dáil all this week. So I visited the leader of the Green Party's home, and I went inside Eamon Ryan's kitchen to have a root around his bin to see if he practices what he preaches. So there I was in his front garden, knocking on the door. He's got five or six bicycles there. He's got lots of wild plants, not to be confused with weeds, but wild plants. It's a red brick, nice house. And I was greeted by his black Labrador, who you can hear panting in the background as we hunt through his bin. And remember, 2.3 billion plastic bottles go unrecycled in this country every year. And the hope is to also ban coffee cups by 2020.
It's kind of embarrassing. You don't want to be people shuffling through your bin. But we do a very simple thing. We tend to unpack stuff here. You come back from the shops or when you're using stuff in the fridge just beside it. And if you can't recycle it, then we put it into the ordinary bin to go into the black bin.
So I'm looking through your bin here. We have a coffee cup. We've got this infamous coffee cup that you're bringing in a bill about today, actually, on this. Someone bought that. But these things, they can't be recycled, can they?
You would think it could be, because they often have little logos on them with the recycling symbol. But that actually means that it's made some materials that might have been recycled. But it itself is a mixture of cardboard and plastic, or card and plastic, and the combination is not recyclable, so it can only go in the black bin. And there's loads of other packaging kind of materials. I mean, when you get a lot of...
So strawberries, I think, a strawberry container. No, yeah. Grapes.
Okay, so you've got two types of plastic in it, a kind of polypropylene kind of cover, I guess, and then a light film plastic container. But again, it's not recyclable. Or certainly it's very difficult to understand whether it is or isn't, or which ones are and which ones aren't. And so much of what we're getting from supermarkets, and we're like any family, you know, you go and buy your grapes, they all come in containers. And the supermarket's doing it for a reason. Like, I suppose for them, it extends the life of the product and it's easy to transport and it's light. But at some point, we're going to have to stop using this plastic.
So there you go. That was me inside Eamon Ryan's bin trying to have a sneak peek. And it's amazing what you can find, even in Aidan McKelvey's bin. You know, you can find out so much about someone's private life, about what they get up to, their secrets, just by looking in their bin. So I also got to speak to Zero Waste Ireland, and they want to get rid of coffee cups. They want to basically do what the Green Party are doing. They want to change things. I met them outside the Dáil, and I also got to visit a well-known supermarket, which I won't name because all the supermarkets have issues with packaging, so it wouldn't be fair. And I met Claudia from Friends of the Earth and Voice Ireland, and we came across packaged melons.
There's like seven slices of melon, and it's on a polystyrene tray and it's wrapped in cling film. Both of those pieces of plastic are not recyclable and they're going straight to landfill. I mean, everything here in front of us, from salads to sandwiches to drinks, everything is covered in plastic, and all of that's going to waste. And we have to bring that home with us, and we have to pay for that rubbish. Our government needs to do something about it. We can bring our own cups, we can bring our own lunchboxes, we can use paper, there's compostable materials, there's plant-based plastics, there's so many options out there today.
Would you be tempted to give the checkout boy or girl the polystyrene and just take the melon?
If I had my own lunchbox, I would put the melon into my lunchbox and leave the plastic here. But I don't think that's the solution either, because it's still going to waste. It's still going to landfill. Whether or not it's the supermarket or it's the customer, I think there has to be a better option for packaging our food.
My name's Jennifer, and I got interested in
the zero waste movement without knowing that's strictly what it was. I started getting stressed out about the idea that just by living a fairly average lifestyle, I was generating so much stuff that has to go somewhere. I think a lot of people are put off, especially by the term zero waste, because it sounds very absolute, very extreme. The most obvious one probably being the idea of getting a reusable coffee cup, and then that's that guilt gone for the rest of your life.
I'm Lawrence. I'm outside the door here today. It's going to be a big day for the country if this bill gets passed in terms of waste reduction. I've realised in kind of my own personal life how much waste that I generate. You know, we've all seen those kind of images of the sea full of plastic.
So Friends of the Earth campaigners there speaking to me. But what about the political parties? Do they support Eamon Ryan's coffee cup ban or bill? Well, they do. They were queuing up outside the door. Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil, and also the Labour leader, Brendan Howlan. I asked him a question. Are you getting involved, I suppose, in the environment now because it's cool, it's trendy, or is it more than that?
Labour Party have always been, and the international labour movement have always been pro-environment. I was Minister for the Environment 20 years ago. In fact, the regulations that would be brought in would be brought in on the basis of legislation that I enacted in the 1990s, the Waste Management Act.
But could you live without coffee cups? I mean, I had one in my hand a second ago.
We could all live with recyclable, compostable coffee cups, the vast bulk of which are not compostable right now. You know, there's a phenomenal number, 2.5 billion unrecyclable cups produced in Britain, many millions here. There's no need for them. We can change the way we do things, we can do things better, and we can protect the environment.
Roisin Chortall, TD, co-leader of the Social Democrats. In relation to the amount of waste that we produced, we produce a huge amount of uncyclable waste, including coffee cups, and we could move to a better form of coffee cup.
But could you live without a coffee cup? Could you?
I can drink my coffee out of Delf cups. I can drink them out of recyclable plastic cups. We just need to ensure that retailers make that change for us and enable us to cut down on the amount of waste that we're producing. So it's very much doable. We don't have to sacrifice our coffee by any means, but we need to use cups that can be recycled.
So politicians there supporting the banning of the humble coffee cup. But what else is inside Eamon Ryan's bin, the leader of the Green Party? I did find a coffee cup and I found many, many other things. So let's go back. Let's look through the keyhole and find out who lives in a bin like this. And I actually once met Lloyd Grossman, but that's a different story. Anyway, let's get back inside Eamon Ryan's bin.
1 minute on the lips and lifetime on the hips. Well, the plastic is equivalent. 1 minute maybe drinking it, and there's about five or six generations for it to biodegrade.
So this
that'll
could
take
be
400 years to
400 years
to biodegrade. We got to stop it. And every kilo of that plastic is 6 kilos of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And about 40% of the plastic bottles we're using are not recycled. They're ending up in dumps. They're ending up as litter. And it's a throwaway culture that's creating this problem. And I think we need to make it easy for everyone to do the right thing by cutting out the waste at source.
Did you really think after you took your rubbish into the door that perhaps I would be rummaging through your bins like if you were Michael Jackson or something and I'd find something something dodgy in there?
Oh yeah, look at the pills. No, I didn't. I think people themselves realise that there's an avalanche of packaging comes at them, and increasingly they're going to have to pay that because that has to go into the black bin. And even on the things like the cups in terms of, like, do we need to be drinking out of plastic bottles? It doesn't taste as good.
I thought your house would be full of everything recyclable. You would be like Scandinavia, where you would be eating your butter out of maybe some sort of long-lasting china container. But you're like anyone else. I mean, you've got your little nuts here, mixed nuts, and you've also got the packaging from the garlic.
No, we are just like everyone else. We do eat peanuts from Lidl, and we do have garlic in a mesh net.
Do you mind the fact that one of the Sunday papers had a photo of you, you know, with a plastic bottle and also with a coffee cup?
We ain't different. Irish people know that this is something we need to change. So we do too. And there's no difference between ourselves and anyone else in that regard.
So there you go. That was the Green Party leader, Eamon Ryan's bin. And it turns out he's just like the rest of us. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He also has stuff and rubbish and issues with recycling that he just can't quite sort out. But he's trying his best to help us so we can help ourselves. And that's it for this week. And thanks for listening. And a huge thank you to my technician, Lee Duncan, and my producer, Aidan McKelvey. And we're going to play out on this 1983 hit. It still sounds fresh. Here is Fade to Grey by Visage.
Devenir gris.
Anglais.